Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Contrary to popular stereotypes, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people disproportionately experience poverty and food insecurity. On June 4th, 2015, a panel featuring experts from both the food policy realm as well as the LGBT community was held to talk the issues and discuss new research from the Williams Institute and its implications for policymakers and service providers. Heritage Radio Network was there to capture the conversation.
Attending this panel tonight. I'm Adam Romero, and I'm with the Williams Institute. I'm a senior counsel and scholar of law at the Williams Institute. And at the Williams Institute, if you're not familiar, we do economic, demographic, public health, legal, and other research related to sexual orientation and gender identity. And it's our hope that that research better informs discussion and debate about LGBT rights in this country and abroad. And so it's really with that aspiration in mind that we put this panel together. And so I want to first thank the Resnick Program, which is a sister program at UCLA School of Law, as well as the Center for Food Law and Policy at Hunter College, who are our partners in putting this event together. I think this event perfectly captures work that we love to do at the Williams Institute, where we hopefully sort of bring the LGBT perspective to an existing conversation that's already happening about many different areas in which, of course, LGBT people exist. And so we draw on the expertise from the Resnick Program and from Hunter College in order to sort of better inform our own work, as well as areas of research that may not necessarily have yet considered LGBT issues. I also want to thank O'Melveny & Myers, which is hosting this wonderful event and have sort of seamlessly put this together. And as we sort of recognize that we're in this beautiful space with this wonderful food, I think we should also sort of appreciate that we're here to talk about food insecurity among people who don't have enough. And so there's, we should, I think, be very aware of that, and hopefully we are. I also finally have the pleasure of introducing Barbara Turk, who's going to provide some introductory remarks to the substantive issues that we're going to be discussing tonight. Barbara is the Director of Food Law and Policy. Did I get that wrong?
Just food policy.
Food policy, excuse me. With the for New York City in the mayor's office. And prior to her appointment to that position in April 2014, she was a senior fellow at Community Resources. And even before that, has sort of had a number of different roles in social services, including being the executive director of the YMCA of Brooklyn and doing HIV/AIDS work, as well as serving on the board of directors for SAGE, which is a organization that serves programming and advocacy for LGBT, older LGBT people. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Barbara.
Thank you. So thank you very much for having me. Gary, it's a pleasure to meet you. I was not familiar with the Williams Institute, and so thanks to my predecessor, Kim Kessler, I now know about you. I'm really excited to know that you exist. And I'm very excited that you are taking up this topic. Jan Popendick called me or wrote to me one day and said there's been a study done, and it shows that there's a disproportionate impact among lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual people on food, it's food security. And I gracelessly responded, that's not a surprise. But I think what, you know, the reason we're here is that, you know, certainly in our, some of us, our long history of doing advocacy and service work in these communities, I think the whole process has always been about raising visibility for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, questioning people, queer people. I will not. Okay, everyone. Everyone, however they identify. And raising that visibility not only among ourselves and developing our own narratives about what our lives are like and what that means, but also trying to raise visibility in places where there is invisibility. And so I think the thing that everybody's excited about here is that this is not a conversation that we hear, as those of you up on this panel we've talked about a little bit. It's not a conversation that we hear on a regular basis in the course of our work on food insecurity. We talk about race and ethnicity, we talk about poverty, we do not talk about gender nonconformity or sexual orientation when we do this work so much. The non-surprise is that marginalized people would be food insecure, right? There are a lot of interesting implications from where I sit for this conversation, not the least of which, and I know that you'll hear more from my colleagues up here about this in a minute, but it really did get me thinking. My organizing head was kind of spinning about, okay, so how do we raise visibility? Who do we raise visibility with? We, in New York City, had an organization that Amber Hollibaugh ran and Joan DiFilippi ran, right? I'm looking at Terry Bogus because she was at the LGBT Center here in New York for many, many years. And we had something called Queers for Economic Justice here in New York City that, I'm getting some nods, which is great, which died, right, for lack of funding. And then some of us would say that the funding went elsewhere. A lot of that funding went into, some of the big funding went into advocating for marriage. Marriage is probably a good idea from an anti-poverty perspective. But a lot of the other organizations that we're talking about, queer people's lives beyond marriage and relationship, have not survived. And Queers for Economic Justice was one of them. So we have lost the one place where that was the front and center conversation. It's not that it's not front and center, it's not that it's not involved, you know, that other organizations aren't talking about this. And certainly when I was on the board of SAGE, when I was on the board of Hedrick Martin, you know, the kids who were coming in, we talked about the lives and life circumstances of those kids and opportunities all the time. So I have a million questions.
I think I did that,
now.
Sorry.
It's all right.
Somehow.
It's okay.
I did not want to silence you.
It's okay.
Mr. Short.
Kim, it's okay. I'm glad that Kim and I are getting a chance to do something together. This is
yes,
really great.
It's really
and it's really fun. But I think the other thing I want to just reflect on is a conversation, quickly before I turn it over to Gary, is a conversation I had just today with my friend Lori Parise. Lori Parise runs an organization called Youth Represent. I don't know if any of you have heard of it. It's rather small. And they provide a piece to a lot of youth-serving organizations around legal representation for kids who are either at risk of or in the process of being kicked out of their homes because they have criminal histories and these are kids who all have some involvement with the criminal justice system, and because of their records, it's in the way of their success. They're either at risk of being kicked out of their homes because they live in public housing and public housing has issues with this. They are at risk of being kicked out of school because of disciplinary actions. They are often, the biggest problem, of course, is employment, and some of you are involved in the drop the box conversation, perhaps, which is, we want to get rid of that box that you have to check that says that you have a criminal history. So anyway, so this is the organization that this is, and so she's working with a lot of kids who are court involved. And I have, in my campaign to make hunger visible, to make people who are food insecure visible, we say there's 1.4 million people in the city who are in this town who are food insecure, but like the gay days, people don't sit around and go, not everybody comes out as hungry. people do come out as, you know, my family, we benefited from SNAP benefits, but there's not that same kind of coming out, if you will, around hunger. So a lot of our work is on visibility. And a lot of this for her, I said, do you have kids who are hungry in your programs? And she says, you know, I do, but we don't ask them. And I think this is something where we have a real opportunity. We have a lot of institutions that we've built in this town over the last, in New York City, and I know that abroad in the other cities, that we've built. And I don't know that this is as much on the radar screen of youth serving organizations, of senior serving organizations, and everybody else, the center. I don't know what happens around really asking the question, some of the questions that are on that the USDA survey, and you know, Pierre will talk to you about what those questions are in a minute. But a lot of us have been talking about it. There's been some work done on building in more of a consciousness around the kinds of questions that we normally ask on a census form, but having those being asked by our service organizations, and then having the capacity to do something about that. And not even in a bureaucratic way. Lori and I were just talking about putting in an extra refrigerator and giving it to the kids and saying, you tell us what you want us to buy, we'll put the food in there, it'll be here. You know, kids won't necessarily take the food if you just say, you know, please take this, but, you know, by the way, pick up some snack and come over and talk to me kind of thing, right? Very informal, no shame, whatever. But this is a kind of radical hospitality. I'm not now going faith-based on you. This is a kind of a radical hospitality that I think we those of us who've been involved in HIV and AIDS and lesbian and gay organizations recognize as the kind of radical hospitality that we extend to each other, that we extend, that our allies extend to us and so forth, that really makes a change and creates community. And how can we not do that if we have people among us who are hungry? So I would like to turn this over to Gary now and the panel. I'm really excited to hear from you.
Thank you. Actually, can go use that mic.
Okay, so this is fun. Thank you so much, Barbara. That was a really excellent setup for the conversation we're going to have. I am going to introduce the panel and first briefly introduce myself. I'm Kim Kessler. I'm with the Resident Program for Food Law and Policy at UCLA School of Law, which, for those of you who are lawyers or here at O'Melveny, you know that is a kind of new thing at law school, so it's exciting. It's one of the first programs in the country where a law school is focusing on issues of food, and we're happy to be part of this conversation, which for me, because I was previously in Barbara's role working on food policy issues here in New York City, it's really exciting to bring together my colleagues at UCLA with many people that I've worked with in city government before. But as Barbara said, what was really interesting to me was soon after actually I joined the program at UCLA that the Williams Institute put out their first report on this a little over a year ago. And, you know, I thought while it's not necessarily surprising, this is not a conversation I have heard happening in working on hunger issues and being part of the anti-hunger conversation here in New York. And I think today is going to be a really enriching discussion, and I want to just briefly introduce each of these people because I think we probably couldn't have brought together a better group to talk about this. So Gary, who's going to be going over the work of the Williams Institute and the research he's done, he's a recognized expert on the demography of the LGBT community and has published extensively on demographic, geographic, and economic characteristics of this population. His research has been cited many, many places, including throughout national and international media outlets. His background is he has a PhD in public policy from Carnegie Mellon, and he is currently a distinguished scholar and research director at the Williams Institute. Next, we have Jan Papendick. She is a professor of sociology at Hunter College. She's also the director of public policy at the New York City Food Policy Center at Hunter, our co-sponsor for this event tonight. Jan also has written extensively in the areas of poverty, hunger, and food assistance. Most recently, she's the author of Breadlines, Knee Deep in Wheat, which was an update of her first major publication, actually. She's also a recipient of the James Beard Foundation Leadership Award for Leaders in Food Policy. And she has her PhD from Brandeis and her graduated from Duke. We also have Triada Stampus. She's the Vice President for Research and Public Affairs at the Food Bank for New York City, one of the leading anti-hunger organizations here in New York. in that role, Triada leads the food bank's efforts in research and evaluation, government relations, and policy advocacy and community mobilization, and she has led a number of successful campaigns in those areas, as I have observed over time, quite directly. She previously worked for New York City Council as the director of the New York City Council's Investigations Division, and she's a graduate of Harvard and Columbia University. And then we have Alana Redfeld, who is the director of LGBTQI Affairs at the Human Resources Administration here in New York City. That's the largest social services agency and primary provider of public benefits. Administers the food stamp programs, among a number of other important public benefits programs here in New York. And Alana, prior to joining HRA, was a staff attorney with the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, an advocacy organization for low-income transgender people and transgender people of color, which many of you probably are familiar with. She's a graduate of CUNY Law School and NYU. So, great group to have. I'm going to turn it over to Gary to present his work.
Thank you very much. And thank you all so much for being here. Thank you all the people who have were involved in organizing this panel. I think this is an amazing event here today. I'm going to talk about some of the data that we have around issues of food security and the intersection of that with sexual orientation and gender identity. And I'm going to start by saying that in general, I think that people think there's much more data about the LGBT population than there actually is. I suspect that if I asked all of you, when is the last time you filled out a survey in which you were asked explicitly to identify your gender identity or your sexual orientation on a survey, most people, it's been quite a while if they've ever been asked that on a survey. So the data resources are rare. So we, at the Williams Institute, devote a lot of time and energy to developing better data resources, both public and private. And you're going to see the fruits of our labor here today. Two of the three data sources that I'm going to talk about, the Williams Institute has been directly involved in getting them to add questions that measure sexual orientation and gender identity. One is the National Health Interview Survey, which is the nation's largest health routinely, it's an annual health survey conducted by HHS that kind of is the way in which we measure these goals around the country's health and includes food insecurity. The second that we were very much involved with is the Gallup organization. And the story of that is, I will just very quickly tell, is that a few years ago I came out with a paper in which we had like four or five surveys, and I tried to estimate the proportion of the population that identified as LGBT, somewhat as T, I had far fewer resources for the T, looked at portions of the population that had same-sex sexual behavior and portions that had same-sex sexual attraction. But anyway, it got a lot of attention because I had said that the LGBT identity measure was about 3.5%, which everybody was mortified that that was way too low. And so Gallup saw all the attention, and so they actually asked Americans on a survey, they ran a poll, and they asked them, well, what portion of the population do you think is LGBT? And Americans said about 20 to 25% of the population. So that's what Americans think. And Gallup thought to themselves, huh, that's a pretty big difference. Why don't we start asking this question on our survey so that we can actually provide some answers here? And so they have a daily tracking survey. Every night in this country since 2012, 1,000 people have asked whether they identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. And what I think is actually important about that is that 1,000 people every night are asked that question who have probably never been asked that question before. And I think it's an incredibly, whatever about the data, and it's an amazing data resource, and I'll show you some results of that, but it's also just a very, I think, important tool for visibility. And so you'll see some findings. So I was involved in helping them craft it. You know, it's a very resource-constrained world in surveys, so trying to craft a question that fit what they needed to do. And then the third survey I'm going to show is the National Survey of Family Growth, which is also a Health and Human Services survey. And actually, they were one of the first big government surveys to ask sexual orientation. So the first, as again I said earlier, the question I'm asked is, well, you know, how many LGBT people are there? That's the question. Well, here's the good news. More now than there were even 2 years ago. So one of the things about measuring sexual orientation and gender identity is that it's not a static thing. It's sensitive to, it's an identity measure. And so everyone asks me, what about all the people who don't identify? And I think they are a very important group. And my short answer to that is they are a very important group. But it's also intrinsically interesting for us to understand who does use these terms to identify and what they look like demographically, economically, all of those things. Because we're not including certain people who don't identify doesn't mean that the group who does is somehow invalid or not interesting. They are. And it turns out there's more of them now than even 2 years ago. In the Gallup data in 2012, 3.6% identified. It has been a consistent rise, and this is a period, you know, of great churn in public policy and other things around LGBT issues. We've seen an increase, that's almost 1.5 million more people identifying in just a 2 year span. And if you go back to surveys from the early 90s, it was only about 2%. So, and what this has to do with food insecurity is that, as it turns out, this who identifies is creating an LGBT population that's looking more and more like the general population. And also that as it's becoming more socially accepting, it means that more marginalized groups who in the past may have been more reluctant to identify as LGBT simply because it's one more bad thing about them that they don't want to add on to their list, those communities are now becoming more comfortable identifying. So in the Gallup data, LGBT identity is higher in racial and ethnic minorities than it is in white populations in the US. And so there is change, and that change affects how we think about things like poverty and food insecurity, because the actual underlying group that we're measuring is changing over time, and perhaps changing in ways that you actually get more people who have disadvantage than you did in the past. So in the Gallup survey, one of the measurements they ask, the only really good measurement of food insecurity that we have in these data are, their people are asked whether they didn't have enough money. At some time in the last year, did you not have enough money for food? That's probably one of the broadest measures we could think of food insecurity. And in Gallup, in the non-LGBT population, it's 18%. And it's substantially higher in the LGBT population. That was in 2012. Over the course of 2 years, the economy has improved. These numbers have gone down a little bit, but the gap is still big between LGBT and non-LGBT. It's 10 percentage points difference. There's substantially higher likelihood of LGBT people saying they didn't have enough money for food. What's great about having a couple data sources is that we can say, okay, is that something quirky about how Gallup is measuring, or it, you know, do we see these patterns elsewhere? So if we look at the National Survey of Family Growth, they have a measurement of whether or not you receive SNAP benefits, so food stamps. And this is a survey of 18 to 44-year-olds. And in 2000, they survey over a longer period of time, so it's a 4-year data collection effort. So between 2006 and 10, 15%, and they only measure sexual orientation, so it's only LGB. So non-LGB people is 15%, but it was substantially higher in the LGB population. And it's actually in the 11 through 13, those figures have gone higher. SNAP use has actually gone up. To 20% in the non-LGBT, but again, the gap has remained. So whatever the pattern in the underlying, we've seen a pattern in reflected in the LGBT population, and that gap is still there. And then finally, in 2013, where we don't have any trend data, 2013 was the first time the National Health Interview Survey asked. This is the best survey we have. We can actually use the U.S. Department of Agriculture's definition of food insecurity. They ask, and that's a multi multiple set of questions that ask about your availability, not only of money for food, but your access to nutrition, you know, to good food. It's a battery of questions, and you come up with a metric that says whether you're food insecure or not. And again, the overall number is a little lower of who is food insecure because it's a more kind of complicated measure, but the gap is still there. LGB people still have higher levels, and substantially higher levels, of food insecurity. I mean, that's almost like a 70% higher rate if you think about the difference between 14% and 8%. So substantially more likely to be food insecure. So the question that we have is, okay, why is that? Is it because people have this particular sexual orientation or gender identity, or is there something about the underlying characteristics of this group that just make them more likely to be food insecure that actually don't necessarily have to do with their sexual orientation or gender identity? So one of the ways we can kind of tease that out is to look at, well, when we look at these factors like gender, race, ethnicity, education, what does the gap in food insecurity look like across those things? And if we see the gap maintained across demographic groups, then it strengthens our argument that this isn't just about the underlying demographics, it's about sexual orientation and gender identity. So if we start and look at women across these three surveys, you see that in all measures, women have higher levels, LGB or LGBT women have much higher levels of food insecurity than their non-LGB or non-LGBT counterparts. And in men, in the Gallup survey, you see that holds true for men. In the other surveys, in the National Health Interview Survey, the food insecurity measure, it is higher in LGB, but it's not statistically significant. And the difference in SNAP participation, it's actually lower in the NSFG. But it still suggests that it's not entirely being driven by, for instance, differences in the proportion that are male and female in these underlying populations. But then if we look at other demographics like age groups, in every single age group in the Gallup data, LGBT people report are more likely to say that they don't have enough money for food in the last year. And if we look by educational attainment, in every single educational group, even in people with postgraduate degrees, LGBT people are more likely to say that they didn't have enough money in the last year for food. So this isn't about simply the underlying demographics. And then finally, we look at race and ethnicity. And again, in every single racial and ethnic category, LGBT show higher rates. There are different rates across racial ethnic groups, and those differences are reflected within LGBT. So, you know, one of the things you can take from this is that when you are LGBT and African American, Hispanic, American Indian, Alaska Native, or something else, it's incredibly high levels. It's almost 4 in 10 in all of those groups who say that at some time in the last year they didn't have enough money food, and it's more like, you know, 3 in 10 in their non-LGBT counterparts. So we did this paper about 2 years ago, and we're now in the process. This is kind of previewing some findings from updated data that we have in all three of these data sources. So we're hoping to release a report within the next few months. There will be a much more comprehensive look at this issue. The one thing I will say, I don't know how many complete data geeks we have in here, but if you do a model where you take into account all of these factors, you get the finding that LGB or LGBT identity is associated with higher levels of food insecurity. So even when you take all of this, these are you know, the cross-section things, but if you take that into account into a more sophisticated what we call regression models, take those all into account, it's always significant that that identity, LGB or LGBT identity, matters. And so I am not an expert in food insecurity, so what I'm delighted to be here is to have folks who can reflect on, well, what does that mean? Like, I can tell you in the data that it exists. It's exciting for me to hear from our other panelists to talk about, well, so in a policy perspective and even in our day-to-day anecdotal experience, why is this and what does it mean for our community and what does it mean for broader food policy issues? And so I will turn it over to the panel. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and I'm going to start.
Do you want the mic, Jen?
Yeah.
I guess so.
So what we're going to do is have each of our panelists talk briefly, and then we'll have some questions, and then followed by audience questions.
Send it over here. I'm not sure I need it. But I want to start, Gary, by thanking you and the Williams Institute for doing this work. Because I remember that exchange, Barbara, when I wrote to Barbara, hey, there's this neat new report, and it was kind of like, this is not a surprise, because I think it was somewhat of a surprise for me. And I think that in some ways I'm the target of the work that you've done, because I've had my whole academic and adult life embedded in the anti-hunger movement. And so I think that the question is, has the anti-hunger movement paid attention to this? And the answer is a resounding no. We fret a lot about the incredible whiteness of being in the anti-hunger movement, and we fret about whether we're engaging youth, but I have never actually heard a discussion of rates of food insecurity and hunger among members of the LGBT community. Kenan actually asked us to start by introducing the work of our center, so I'll just say very quickly that the New York City Food Policy Center at Hunter College is embedded in the School of Public Health, and that our focus is on policies that relate to food insecurity and to access to healthy food, to foods that contribute or fight diet-related disease, for New Yorkers and for municipalities. We are interested in what cities can do to address these two big challenges of diet-related disease, especially obesity, diabetes, hypertension, and food insecurity. And we're an interdisciplinary group, and we work on intersectoral policies. But my role within the center has very much been I have the food insecurity portfolio. And like anybody who writes about food insecurity and hunger, there are language issues, and I wanted to take a minute to talk about it. Food insecurity is a technical sounding term that loses some of the passion about hunger. Some of the outrage that we ought to feel about people not having enough to eat the right food to lead a healthy life in a society that's swimming or drowning in food. And I was struck by a parallel kind of language issue in the study. So hunger, and I understand the hashtag, if you're tweeting, is LGBT hunger for this session. Is it hunger? Is it food insecurity? What is food insecurity? When is hunger food insecurity? And when is food insecurity hunger? Sharman Russell has written that, quote, hunger is a country we enter every day like a commuter across a friendly border. Hunger is a normal part of our lives, and without hunger and satiety, we wouldn't know when to eat or when to stop. So hunger is not always a problem, but when hunger is prolonged, when it's involuntary, when it's intense, when it continues beyond the healthy level, then it's a huge problem, and it's a problem for all of us in society, not just for the individuals who are hungry. I think of it as the question of kind of how hungry does someone have to be and for how long or how often before it becomes a matter of public policy. And I thought about these language things when I was first reading Gary's report, because two of the measures, the one about there were times in the last year when I didn't have enough money to buy food. And the ones about measuring food insecurity get at the problem. But from my world, SNAP participation is a solution, not a problem. It's a problem that people are poor enough to be eligible for SNAP. But if people are poor enough to be eligible for SNAP, we want them to participate. So that's a number that we want to go up, and we want to see high rates of SNAP participation among eligible people in LGBT and all other communities. And that leads me to want to unpack these numbers a tiny bit to just report that there is very strong evidence that SNAP participation reduces food insecurity, so that it has been difficult to measure, because if you take large population surveys, there's a self-selection. People who are in need are the ones who apply for and achieve SNAP benefits. But some very clever colleagues of yours in the data mining industry found that if they compared food insecurity rates for new entrants to SNAP, if they asked people about their food insecurity experiences in the past 30 days when they first, in a sense, joined SNAP, and then asked them again after 6 months of participation, they could measure a substantial reduction in food insecurity rates, so around 10 percentage points, which is very, very important and valuable. When we look at issues that affect SNAP participation, obviously the percentage of people in the population who are eligible affects it. So when we have a great recession, SNAP is thoroughly countercyclical, and the rates of participation go up quite dramatically, and did during the recent Great Recession. But in addition to the issue of how many people are eligible, there's a question of the take-up rate. Is SNAP fully accessible? Do people know about it? Is it destigmatized sufficiently for people to make use of it? Are there barriers? And we've lived through a very interesting period in the last 6-7 years where many of the barriers to SNAP access have been reduced. We got rid of finger imaging almost everywhere. New York was kind of late in the game. But perhaps more interestingly, at least from my observation, is that mayors and governors around the country came to realize that SNAP benefits fueled their economies, so that it became, rather than let's keep people off SNAP, let's get those federal dollars into our communities and circulating. The ratio is typically about $1.8 worth of economic activity for every dollar of SNAP benefit. And with a little help from Mark Zandi of the Money Watch, there was a great rise in awareness of the value of SNAP benefits to the economies of communities. So then that leads me to my final comment, which is, what can we do to make sure that SNAP benefits are really fully accessible to the LGBT community and to all Americans in need? And for there, I come down to the issue of raising the SNAP benefit. We had an experiment in a higher SNAP benefit, because the ARRA, the Stimulus Act, temporarily boosted the SNAP benefit level, and that coincided with participation going up. It became worth it for more people to overcome the barriers, to put up with the inconvenience, what have you. So we know that a more generous benefit will probably enable the program to reach more of those in need. So when we get to the kind of advocacy issues, I want to talk about how can the LGBT community help in the task of raising the SNAP benefit. I guess I'll pass it to Tria.
All right, thank you, Jan. And First, I want to thank the organizers and the presenters of tonight's event. I'm here as a respondent, which means other people have done the hard work, and I just get to share my thoughts and react. My name's Triada Stampas. I'm Vice President for Research and Public Affairs at Food Bank for New York City. We're an organization that's been around for 32 years, serving a network of close to 1,000 food pantries, soup kitchens, senior centers, community-based organizations, and schools, primarily through food distribution. But over the course of our organization's evolution, we've really taken on a much broader anti-hunger mission, recognizing as time went on that the food that people need tonight or to take home for tomorrow is not going to change the systemic and root causes of what's driven them to a food pantry or soup kitchen to begin with. And so in addition to our food distribution, we run the country's biggest food stamp outreach program to get that sustainable income support for food. We provide free tax services this year to 85,000 low-income New Yorkers so that they get their refunds and credits without having to pay sometimes exorbitant fees to private tax preparers. We provide nutrition education and financial counseling so that low-income folks know how to get the best nutritional bang for their buck, both with the food preparation and cooking skills, but also the home budgeting skills to really make the most of the very limited resources that they have. And we do policy and advocacy, and that's primarily my role. I get to be kind of the resident geek in a very large organization that provides a lot of services. And as I listened to the presentation and reviewed the research and listened to the opening remarks from Barbara, there were three or four issues that really kind of stood out for me. And one, the first, I think, was visibility. Like Barbara, my first reaction when I read this stuff was, well, of course, LGBT populations are experiencing food insecurity at higher rates. But like Jan, my very next thought was, we're never talking about that. You know, that's really something that the visibility within the anti-hunger community hasn't been there. And I think about my organization's evolution and development over the years. Most, 70% roughly, of the food pantries and soup kitchens that we serve come out of faith-based organizations. And then there's a small pocket of organizations that over time became food bank members to serve the HIV and AIDS population, recognizing that low-income people with AIDS or with symptomatic HIV or even non-symptomatic HIV need help addressing their nutritional needs, sometimes very specific nutritional needs to support their health. And, you know, it really hit me that our network, having evolved over time as it has, because it really has been an evolution from the early 1980s when hunger first became visible on the streets in a way that it hadn't been before, and the very sort of ad hoc and haphazard community response of organizations and houses of worship starting their own food pantries and starting their own soup kitchens because they saw community members struggling and didn't know what to do about it other than collecting food and collecting money and making sure people had what they needed. That has happened organically over time, but I think what this suggests is that we're in a moment that requires a different intentionality and strategy about making sure that our network really rolls out the welcome mat to everyone and that we're not letting people slip through the cracks. And when we talk about, and I think that's what's happened, right? Like in terms of visibility, there's a slipping through the cracks. Part of that, frankly, is driven by the fact that you know, the reliance on the charitable sector to do the a lot of the heavy lifting on anti-hunger work. We have an excellent public safety net in the food stamp program, but over the years, and there are other income supports, but over the years that safety net has gotten frayed, and more people are turning to charitable organizations like food pantries and soup kitchens that have to raise money by whatever means they can And when I think about the kind of marketing that anti-hunger organizations do to raise their dollars, the visibility of need among LGBT populations isn't there, because the most sympathetic face of hunger is a child. So the story we're often telling as we're raising money to do the work that we need to do to fill in the gaps in in an insufficient safety net leads us to exclude the stories of need that are out there but aren't necessarily the most sympathetic poster child for the cause, right? Nobody wants to see a kid go hungry. And so that raises a lot of money for us. Nobody wants a senior to go to bed hungry. That's another popular story. But other stories get left out because they may not be as lucrative a fundraising message, to be perfectly frank. And that's not to condemn the work of the charitable sector. It's a position that we are in part because what started as an emergency response to hunger, you know, addressing people's emergency needs, has become a way of addressing chronic need, that it's a regular source of food. We have people, 42% of the city's SNAP population, so 42% of people in New York City who are already getting food stamps are also turning to food pantries and soup kitchens, because those food stamp benefits don't go far enough, don't get them through the month, and in a city like New York where other costs of living are so extraordinarily high, there is no pocket money to make up the difference. And so a food pantry or a soup kitchen is often what makes up that difference. So, you know, it really, whatever it takes to raise the dollars to not turn people away. When 70% of our network is faith-based, 70% of our network, roughly, is also completely volunteer-run. So the people who are giving out food are doing it out of the goodness of their hearts, not because they're making a dollar off of it. And so the last thing they want to do is turn people away and have to be in that position. So it makes this research makes me think about the visibility issue, kind of the reliance of the charitable sector and kind of the funding needs that drive us to contribute to this visibility issue unwittingly, right? We're not intentionally trying to leave out people in need. And it called out for me the need for an intention and a strategy to make sure that as a service providing organization, as an umbrella, as a network that serves our entire city, we really are rolling out the welcome mat to everybody in that way of radical hospitality that Barbara was talking about. And to get a little bit wonky for a moment, it also makes me think that I need to put in a call to Craig Gunderson, an agricultural economist at the University of Illinois, who is the researcher behind the city's metric for food insecurity, which is called the meal gap. And the meal gap does two really important things. One, it translates food insecurity into a number of missing meals. So if a person is food insecure, it's hard to know what that means. But if you can take their resource shortfall for food and translate that into a number of meals, it's a lot easier to get your head around the need. Right now in New York City, there's a meal gap of 241 million. So that is 241 million meals that people in need are going without over the course of a year. That's an enormous number. So the meal gap translates food insecurity, which is this abstract, wonky term, into a number of meals, and that's important. The other thing the meal gap does is it takes that USDA food insecurity metric, which is done in the American Community Survey, which is an annual survey the census does that samples people, and it applies through a regression analysis some other factors and variables that let you take those estimates and really drill down to a local level, so that you can take food insecurity in New York City at the borough level and really get it down to a neighborhood level and understand how is need in Bed-Stuy different than need in East New York, different than need in Brooklyn Heights, and how is that different than need in Jamaica or Far Rockaway or the Upper West Side or, you know, East Tremont in the Bronx. So that's also, for a city and especially for a service provider in the city, a really important tool to be able to look at need. And two of the factors that go into the meal gap, there's a number of factors that go into the meal gap, poverty and unemployment, median household income, but also the percent of the population that's African American and the percent of the population that's Hispanic or Latino. And the reason for that is because those two variables, even when you take into account employment status and home ownership and things like that, still are strongly associated with food insecurity in ways that can't be explained by other factors. And this suggests to me that Craig should look at LGBT status and build that in so that.
Get a question on the ACS, please.
He's actually former USDA, so maybe he can, actually, if anybody can. He probably can. So it suggests to me that this meal gap measure, which is far and away the most sophisticated measure of food insecurity in the country, can be refined further still, and this is important information to feed into that. So I think that covers the main points that I had. In response to this research. So thank you again for doing this.
Great. Thank you. Thanks so much to the panel, the Williams Institute. I'm really happy to be here. I really appreciated Barbara mentioning QEJ, Queers for Economic Justice. How many people are familiar with QEJ? Good, a lot of people. So for those of you who are not, Queers for Economic Justice was an amazing organization that worked on poverty issues in queer communities, and it was led by and for low-income queer people. They actually produced some of the first really awesome information around welfare, accessing welfare, and accessing public benefits in low-income communities. I was thinking about A Fabulous Attitude, which is the name of a report that they generated. And there was a project called the Welfare Warriors, where a lot of this great leadership was coming from. So Queers for Economic Justice was part of this larger building called the Miss Major J. Toole Building, which is named after some queer activists. And I had the pleasure of working in that building for a few years. And one of the projects that was really central to all the groups that were part of that building, and that included the Audre Lorde Project, it included the Sylvia Rivera Law Project where I worked, and it includes Streetwise and Safe and Fierce, all these great organizations working with communities of color and low-income communities that are LGBTQI identified. So one of the main core projects was looking at HRA, Human Resources Administration, which is New York City's provider of public benefits and also jobs programs. And so through the years, there was this great campaign to push HRA to provide these benefits in a way that's really accessible for community members and to make sure to address obstacles to obtaining benefits and to accessing services. And therefore, it was kind of amazing when last year we had a new commissioner and a really amazing opportunity to go in there and look at what HRA's policies are. So I came on at just the beginning of this year as the director of LGBTQI affairs, which is part of this initiative within HRA to look at communities that may be particularly vulnerable or have issues around access, and how can we address those issues. So I'll tell you the points I really want to make sure come across, and then I'll try to make them. One is that government interventions can help. Two is that a critical piece in that is access, which is related to your ability to be respectful and affirming for all of your participants and clients who are accessing services. And then my third point is that initiatives like HRA's, current initiatives, will help improve access to food. So I will say we serve about 3.5 million people at HRA, and there is not information about how many of those people may identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, questioning, gender nonconforming. But we do recognize that there are these poverty factors out there. With research like we have from the Williams Institute and with these amazing studies that came out of groups like Queers for Economic Justice, we know that there are LGBTQI people may be disproportionately likely to live in poverty and access public benefits. So we've put this project together to try to really increase visibility of LGBTQI issues at HRA and increase awareness across the board. One of the big components of that is training all the staff, and another component is to look at all of our policies and see where they can be improved or built out to support LGBTQI people accessing services. And in, as part of that process, we've also been working on a needs assessment for our clients. That would be a survey and focus groups. We've had some awesome support from Williams Institute in that regard. And we're hoping to get that out this summer so that we can get some more of this information directly from the people who are using our services. We also have a work group, and a work group is an opportunity for anybody, for advocates and for committee members to come in and talk to us and strategize with us about how we should be doing this work, whether it's the needs assessments, or whether it's the trainings, or whether it's our policies. So there's all these projects happening. We also want to hear directly from program participants about what they're seeing as problems. So as these things are happening, there's this is, I think of it as one of two problems. This problem is about increasing our ability to support and engage with LGBTQI community members. And then the other piece is that we have a strong commitment to really getting out there and doing outreach around the benefits that are available. So there are these great initiatives happening in HRA now that I want to touch on briefly. One of which is foodhelp.nyc. How many people have heard about foodhelp.nyc? Great, okay. So what foodhelp does is an online website that allows you to connect quickly with emergency food assistance, and it will also help you connect with longer term ongoing benefits through the SNAP programs. So check it out, it's a great website. I think it's easy to use, accessible, and it can get you connected to benefits right away. And then the second really, really amazing initiative is Access NYC. And Access NYC is an initiative from the mayor's office that allows people to go to a kind of central hub to enroll in public benefits, various kinds of benefits. So there's a screening tool, and there's a lot of information available on the site, and it's a great way for people to connect with various programs that are out there. And I think that these two initiatives are really important because of the access issues that exist for LGBTQI communities. So you may not want to go and engage with workers immediately. Maybe you don't feel comfortable because of being transgender or feeling concerned about your sexual orientation. So these initiatives give an opportunity to get your foot in the door earlier and easier. There is still a component of having to come into the office and work with HRA members, but we think it's a really, really great opportunity to get the ball rolling, get the process moving. And also, those HRA workers are being trained and are being supported around how to really be knowledgeable on LGBTQI issues and connect our clients with the services that they need. The last point I want to mention on that too is that we're spreading out how SNAP enrollment happens. So there are all these enrollment centers around the city that are great places to go to get the ball rolling as well. And right now there's a lot of CBOs. I don't remember the number of CBOs, but there's quite a few community-based organizations, 80-ish. And I'm not sure if there are any LGBT-specific enrollment sites. I don't know if you know.
I don't think so either.
Yeah.
So Union Community Health Center, SAGE, has a new office there.
Okay.
They do, they're a POS enroller.
Okay.
Yes, I looked into it. So that's great to know, and hopefully that will increase over time, because this is a program that organizations can enroll in and get involved in moving forward. And related to that, we're also trying to increase other ways for people to provide information for enrollment in SNAP, including potentially having mobile uploadability, so people could bring in documents that way through taking pictures. So that's sort of a vision coming down the line. So all these initiatives are really targeted towards getting more people involved and making sure that when they are involved that they're receiving services in an affirming way and supportive way. So that's all I have to say for now.
Great. Thank you, all of you, so much. So we have a little bit of time left. I'm going to ask a couple of questions and then see if there are some audience questions. But one thing that came up in a few people's remarks, but Triada talking about the methodical gap and the need to understand, to get the data collection around LGBT to be stronger and more robust. I know, Gary, that's actually something the Williams Institute, and we've done a little bit of work with you this has been working on, and I wanted to give you a chance to speak to that.
Yeah, I think, so we've done a lot of work in a wide swath of federal agencies. It's just a very difficult challenge to get survey people to consider adding new questions to their surveys. And part of that actually has little to do with resistance around sexual orientation and gender identity. It's just resistance to adding things, to change in surveys, because there's this strong feeling that you want to keep comparability over time and all of these things. So, but I think we've had some great successes. We've done a lot of work with the Census Bureau to improve. At the moment, they generally in census surveys don't measure sexual orientation or gender identity, but you could measure same-sex couples. It turns out they've not been doing that well over time, and we've done a lot of great work with them to improve that. But we have gotten sexual orientation items. We've done some amazing work with the department, and Adam has been very involved with this with the Department of Justice, and as well as the National Health Interview Survey that you saw there. We'll have some really solid sexual orientation. I think the hardest sell right now has been around these surveys that are socioeconomically oriented. So surveys from the Census Bureau, from the Department of Labor, and things like the Current Population Survey of the ACS that have these, that are not sort of health mandated, which people in their heads still see as the more logical place for sexual orientation and gender identity. I think that it's been a tougher road. We've done some work with USDA, and Adam, I don't know if you want to make any specific comments about that, but certainly, again, we've been involved with all of these agencies. And the truth is, the way that this will happen is more from other government and other agencies who use data to tell these surveys, we need these data. We can say it a lot, but actually, if they hear it from their users, and even more importantly, from some of their funders, it will make a big difference. So to the extent that any of you have access in that way to these, and the other way we can do it is that on our local surveys, start asking these questions. So I'd love to get it on these big federal surveys, but the truth is, oftentimes we've worked very hard. We just got we've had sexual orientation measure on the California Health Interview Survey for almost a decade, but we worked very closely with them at the Williams Institute. Worked very closely with them over the last 2 years, and we're now going to have gender identity on the largest population-based survey that has that kind of measurement ever. And it turns out, it's not that hard to measure gender identity. Everyone got very freakish about that. It turns out it's way harder to measure sexual orientation than it is to measure gender identity. And that's largely because heterosexuals don't know that they're straight. So when you ask sexual orientation questions, the big majority doesn't know what they are. They've never had to think about it. People know what their gender is. They know that intuitively. And it turns out, for a bunch of geeky survey reasons, that's a good thing, and it makes it actually easier to measure gender identity than it does to measure sexual orientation. So it's what the sexual orientation is what led the National Health Interview Survey. To identify as straight in the National Health Interview Survey, you have to check the box that says straight, that is, not gay. Because it turns out people know whether they're gay or not. They don't actually know whether they're straight. But with gender, that's not a problem. You know whether you're male or female, or if you identify as something different than that. It doesn't mess up people know what they are. And so it's a much easier construct to measure. And so what I'm trying to promote around the gender identity thing is that all of our surveys measure gender. Almost all of our surveys ask your gender. We're doing it really poorly. If all we're doing is asking male or female, we're doing a really bad job of measuring a construct that we claim is important. So in that case, I'm not asking surveys to somehow add something new. I'm just asking them to measure something they already care about more effectively and more accurately. And our, and I actually think it should be an easier sell to get gender identity measurement than sexual orientation in that sense. Because everybody's measuring gender. Why aren't we doing it better? And so, you know, but again, with sexual orientation, I think we've gotten some good response from several big agencies, and that'll help to make it more widespread. But to the extent that anybody can do local work in that regard, anytime there are local agencies that find these things, it helps make the case for larger scale surveys that it's important.
So we heard, I think, everyone kind of agreeing and having consensus around that this data is, in a sense, a wake-up call for the anti-hunger community. And some ideas from Triada and Alana about what the implications of that might be. Triada in particular talked about intentionality. And I wanted to just hear from you all, maybe drilling down a little bit more, like even aspirationally, what might sort of some of the strategies be? What are the things that you think can be done, should be done, should be thought about, the conversations that should happen around this topic?
I would say, well, first, I'm really excited that Alina's position exists. I think it helps guard against the hazard that I was talking about of reliance of the nonprofit sector to kind of solve all problems. Is we don't, like, we can't, and we leave stuff out, and it's not intentional. And to raise visibility, particularly when you're talking about marginalized population, you need a policy commitment, and so to have this position in existence now is incredibly important, and I think will do, you know, will make a significant advance in raising visibility for the need for social services of all kinds among LGBT population. I think for us, what it points towards is, we know, because we have this measure of the meal gap, we know where food insecurity is greatest, we know where there are the most missing meals, and we have a commitment as an organization and as a network to do more where need is greatest, and it's about identifying partners and making sure that the partners that we work with really are committing to and adhering to a lot of the standards that have been set for emergency food providers. You know, there are a whole set of rules. If you're going to give out a pantry bag or serve a meal as a soup kitchen, you can't proselytize, you can't charge money, you can't do anything that makes a person feel unwelcome, in large part because there's a lot of government funding behind it, and so there's a strong commitment to being non-discriminatory and making sure that as we're going out to our food pantries and our soup kitchens and doing technical assistance and monitoring sites, that we're sensitizing ourselves and sensitizing our members to the sorts of things that might be unwelcoming. So that's, I mean, I think kind of next steps for us and the thinking that we're doing, but to know that we have partnership in this at a policy level in government is, like, makes a world of difference.
Thank you. I actually do want the microphone.
Okay.
Thank you. So I would say that with regard to collaboration between government and activists and community members, like, transparency and access are so important that you have to be able to communicate needs and collaborate together in order to make sure that the best possible benefits are being provided in the best possible way. But also, broadly speaking, I feel like a key component of fighting hunger and food insecurity is going to be intersectionality, like looking at the different kinds of communities that are organizing around it and making sure that we don't have just a panel about LGBTQI food insecurity and then one about racism and food insecurity and one about disability and food, that there's collaboration happening around how to do the coalition building together. So that when policies are made and proposed and put forward and they come eventually to government, that they are policies that are going to benefit everyone.
Anybody in the audience have a question?
Sure. You want to go, Devin?
I may be asking the same question as you. I want to talk about race.
I want to talk about some of that.
Yeah, just following up on the intersectionality issue. I wonder if you could comment on, because structural racism and forms of oppression underlie hunger in America, about racism and gender oppression within the LGBT community. As a gay man, I'm always concerned that the community, you know, is still led by white men of affluent means, and how do we begin to address those issues, perhaps using hunger as a motivation to deal with those issues?
I'll just make a quick, less so about the structure of the movement and more just to say that there's emerging evidence, in not just in food issues, but generally in poverty, of this, again, the intersectionality of race and ethnicity and sexual orientation in ways that it's not necessarily additive, but certainly that these intersections create very unique circumstances, some of which are quite difficult, and create particularly acute situations around economic disadvantage for LGBT communities. And I think that awareness, to your point, I think we have long struggled with a mythology that suggested that there was a lot of wealth in the community, and that was in fact used to advance rights, and quite frankly used kind of effectively. Like, I mean, when you think about what happened in Indiana and Arkansas, these were business cases for essentially what, like, it stopped bad laws because businesses believed that they had a consumer base that cared about these issues. But that has a bad side to it. And I think the bad side is, A, it's actually false as a premise that there's excessive wealth. That's not actually, there's no grounding for that in reality. And B, it's bad because it has created a situation where people are surprised when they hear these kinds of findings. So I think within the movement, the challenge is, as I think several people have talked about, the movement has to engage in these other issues. So the LGBT movement also, so not only does the food movement, the whatever, have to think about sexual orientation, the LGBT movement has to begin to say, these are our issues. So it has, that's from both sides, I think. And I'm hopeful that some of the data stuff can help advance that. But I agree with you. I mean, I think a lot of the movement clearly is dominated by a particular look that challenges this. But I think that's what has to happen for this to work, is that the movement has to acknowledge this as a clear priority.
I would just add to that I think a key piece really has to be promoting the leadership of communities of color, and particularly promoting the policy and issues that are coming from communities of color, and making sure that when we say we're talking about LGBT communities or we're talking about LGBT issues, that we're not separating that from racism, or separating, because racism is an LGBT issue.
So I see Adam was ready, and then we'll come back to you, Derek.
Derek.
Am I on? Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay, I guess there are a lot of comments I can make, but one of the things that really kind of struck me is really the fact that we have to talk about movement building. And if you don't talk about movement building, you don't understand what it means to have the 26,000 people suffering from HIV/AIDS in the South Bronx in Harlem. You don't begin to talk about all of the folks who are formerly incarcerated who aren't even eligible for SNAP. Mm-hmm. You do not even begin to talk about that segment of the LBG community that's part of the homeless youth. I could keep going on and on. And so to me, the big value around all of this that we should be talking about is recognizing that while many of us are in the charity business, it is necessary, but it's not sufficient. Mm-hmm. And unless you define things in terms of a transformative way of what else you want to do, and where do you want to be, and where do you want to go 5 years from now, as opposed to all of the mechanisms for raising funds, that only, quite frankly, take a look at the people on SNAP, take a look at the people on homeless. It's all increased in the last 2 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. Yours is a never-ending proposition of raising money to serve even fewer percentage, even though the numbers may be greater, and the pounds of food and the metrics that you use. I also think that we tend to use the poverty concept somewhat not understanding what it means to be beyond broke. And if you want to understand the concept of beyond broke, you just have to walk on 3rd Avenue and 149th Street to see the jewelry store next to the pawn shop. And it describes to you all the data that you're collecting, which basically says that the median liquid income of folks who are black and Latino is less than $300, and for whites it's $22,000. At that particular point, all the metrics that you give me from all your measures that talk about poverty doesn't talk about the depth of poverty and truly defines what it means for income insecurity and for food insecurity. And so I really think that until we start talking about, yes, necessary peace being the fact that you have to continue to feed people in the hunger movement, but the other piece that where are all of we going to be in terms of a movement that talks about transformation?
And one quick thing I will add to that is that I think one of the things that we have to remember is that in communities where you have these kind of multiple ways in which you might be marginalized or stigmatized, the priority of sexual orientation or gender identity may not be quite as high as it is when you're in a privileged position. And so when it's the privileged people running this, they need to understand that sexual orientation and gender identity may just be one of this multitude of issues that create challenges in these communities. And it may not even bubble up that high if you talk to those groups about, you know, what their challenges are, or certainly not bubble up in the way that you would if you got a, you know, a focus group of a bunch of white gay men who are otherwise, you know, are, for argumentation's sake, are otherwise privileged except for their sexual orientation. And so, of course, sexual orientation kind of bubbles up. And that I think in the intersectionality approach, it's to understand that to not have that bias around the somehow sexual orientation and gender identity is this kind of privileged identity that trumps others. It may not in many of these communities, and that makes it even that much more difficult to find and to understand what the root causes are. And I often think, I think to your issue, when the leadership comes from more privileged, I think that that's a construct that can get very difficult to understand. So it's a challenge that we face.
Adam? I want to add sort of another dimension to all of this, which is geography. As we put this panel together, one thing that was always lurking in the back of my mind is that this is very urban-centric. And New York City, while it has many issues to deal with, also has a lot of resources to respond to those issues. And so, as we know from the poverty research that Gary has been mentioning, we see higher rates of poverty in the LGBT community in rural settings and non-urban settings. And so I wanted to ask the panel if you have any reactions to thinking about this issue from a non-urban perspective.
I first want to challenge the premise of New York having so many resources to address these problems.
I didn't suggest that.
In theory, true. In reality, the amount of money that actually does get put to the problem is insufficient. I mean, we were looking at the numbers, in my shop just the other day. 16% of the city's population relies on a food pantry or soup kitchen. That's one in six people. 0.01% of the city's budget actually goes to helping them. So the sufficiency of resources is purely theoretical and not real in the day-to-day and not really part of the experience of a lot of people in need. Now, that said, what is here may not be in other places, so other places in the country may be even worse off. And I'm not insensitive to that, but I just wanted to sort of, for the record, state there really is not a surfeit of resources going towards addressing economic or inequality, food insufficiency, and any of that really to the extent that we could be or should be.
Yeah.
We're the urban people.
I would just say, like, sorry.
No, go.
I would just say that it's a really real issue, and I think for across the board LGBTQI issues, it's such a vast difference in resources between cities and rural areas. So that's why initiatives are really important that are funding different work in those areas, as well as the research that has to be done to support it. So I think thank you for raising that point, because it's a huge thing. When you look at, also if you look at a map of the LGBT work that gets funded across the country, it's staggering. It's, you know, it's like New York, Atlanta, LA, San Francisco, Seattle, basically, Chicago maybe.
Yeah, please go ahead.
It's a comment and a shameless plug for my work. So I work at the Urban Justice Center, and we do litigation and advocacy around public assistance and food stamps. So we spend a lot of time on the opposite end of hearings with HRA around just all of the issues. And the access question or the access issue is just ginormous, and I spent time today in a meeting with HRA around fraud, and the training thing came up again. And so for me, I don't know if anyone's been to an HRA job center or a food stamp center, but regardless of your gender identity, sexual orientation, the staff there is not welcoming. And so for sure, training has to happen, but I'm just so demoralized at kind of what that would look like, because it's we have a culture of demeaning poor people regardless of how they identify, and I just don't know how training ever gets to that. So I think access is the large question, because we do have to get more people who are eligible on benefits, but I'm just, you know, demoralized. But anyway, if there are other service providers in the room, we have legal clinics around the city where we make ourselves available at food pantries. We're in Bed-Stuy, we're in the South Bronx. We have other clinics in Manhattan, and we have one in Queens. So any service providers in the room, I have flyers, English and Spanish, so send your folks to us, because I think what happens oftentimes is what we've seen for individuals who have multiple identities that are kind of complicated for HRA, meaning low English proficiency, immigration status, folks are budgeted incorrectly, and they are discontinued for, you know, reasons that are illegal, unconstitutional. So, you know, if you have any clients, then send them to us, and I'm willing to kind of stay afterwards and give out flyers. And I think it's also important that to name again the fact that intersectionality is a term by a Black woman, and queers for economic justice, queer people of color, and fierce queer people of color, and there's not a queer person of color. Like, that voice was not here on the panel tonight, and I think we have to kind of name that for sure as we move forward in terms of movement building and, like, what leadership and expertise looks like.
I was taking an opportunity to thank you for the reason that, and also, if you are interested, just say.
I'm going to give you my card for that. If you started, then I'll definitely, like, want to be a part of the conversation with how HRA kind of moves forward in terms of how it deals with folks who are not gender conforming, because it's been, like, painful for me to at times say to my clients, listen, it's going to be emotionally easier for you to not go and apply for food stamps, because it's just, you've already kind of been damaged by going there. So I'd like to not have to have those conversations.
I also want to say thank you for the reminder that poor is its own stigmatized identity. And so the sort of the demeaning that you're talking about is something that happens in every aspect of a low-income person's life, and that is just part of that this whole spectrum that we're talking about. You know, from the moment a person takes out their EBT card to buy their groceries and gets everything in their shopping cart sized up, and judged, you know, about what, you know, why they're making the choices they're making. I mean, it is its own stigmatized identity, and it's important that we acknowledge that too.
And I'd just like to respond. I appreciate the point. Just don't also forget that a queer person of color organized the panel. Me.
So, I'm going to actually
let us, and we're a little bit over time, but I'm going to let, hopefully, conversations can continue in this room, and I think it's been a really productive conversation. It's been, I think I can speak on behalf of all the hosts, our pleasure to convene the conversation, and one that I think is pretty unique, so really good to see it happening. I'm just going to let it end on a little bit of a somber note, because I think it is a somber conversation, and I enjoyed it. I want to thank all of you for being here, and thank all of you for being here. And I hope that people can just continue to talk. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.